Welcome to A Khatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Khatra AI.
Okay, so today we're diving into Kalyan Bradley's novel, The Ministry of Time. And wow, this book really resists any simple category, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those books where you try to explain it and you end up listing like four different genres.
Exactly. Bradley, who's British-Cambodian, she's known for that kind of genre bending. Critics have called this, and I think quite rightly, a mix of, well, swooning romance, really sharp workplace comedy, a proper spy thriller, and yeah, some quite profound science fiction too.
And the core idea is just audacious. You've got this the secret government ministry in Britain near future, and they figured out time travel.
Right.
But they're not, you know, going back to change things. They're extracting people, specific people, plucked from the very moment before they would have died.
And they bring them to the present as expats.
Expats, exactly. Which is such a loaded term even before you add the time travel element. It's all buried under this very, very British layer of, well, bureaucracy.
It really grabs you, that concept. So our mission today, I think, is to look past the, you know, the cool sci-fi surface. We want to really unpack the human cost, the morality of this whole temporal displacement program.
Yeah.
And explore how this seemingly impossible connection between two people from totally different centuries ends up revealing the ministry's truly, well, terrifying real motives.
Definitely. It takes this incredible power, messing with time itself, and then just grinds it through the gears of the civil service. It's brilliant.
And that mix, the fantastical and the totally mundane, sets the tone right away. The ministry's official line is all very dry, very clinical. Gather historical intelligence, study displacement psychology.
Standard government stuff if your government happened to employ time travelers.
It has that satirical edge, doesn't it? Like Vonnegut or Douglas Adams, saving someone's life just to saddle them with paperwork and assimilation protocols.
And the mechanics are laid out with this sort of almost dark humor. You have the historical figures, the expats struggling with Wi-Fi and feminism and central heating.
Temporal refugees, essentially.
Totally. And then you have the civil servants, the bridges, whose job it is to guide them through, you know, smartphones and social media and just basic 21st century life.
Imagine the risk assessments.
Exactly. That's the workplace comedy part. It's grounded in that cultural clash, the sheer absurdity of it all.
And that brings us to our central pair. First, there's the narrator. She's unnamed. She's the bridge. She's sharp, witty, British Cambodian, and feels, well, pretty disconnected herself, doesn't she?
Yeah, there's a definite sense of her own cultural displacement, maybe, which makes her job, being a bridge for someone else, feel almost like a defense mechanism, like she doesn't have to fully belong anywhere herself.
And her assignment, Commander Graham Gore.
Ah, Gore. A real historical figure. Naval officer, polar explorer. He was on Sir John Franklin's doomed 1845 Arctic expedition.
And the ministry pulls him out literally seconds before he would have died.
Right. So he's the ultimate fish out of water, full of that Victorian charm and, you know, principles, but also carrying this immense melancholy loss for his world, his men.
The comrades he feels he abandoned, even though he was saved.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's where the real tension kicks in. The ministry has one absolute unbreakable rule for these bridges.
Uh-huh. No fraternizing.
Zero romantic entanglements. Keep it professional or you're out.
Right.
But what happens when you put two people together who are both profoundly displaced, one across centuries, the other culturally, emotionally?
Could they start to see something in each other? That shared feeling of being an outsider.
And that professional boundary starts to look, well, pretty fragile. Their connection becomes an anchor, maybe.
It really does. It's forged in that shared sense of being adrift. If you look at the narrator's journey, she starts off so guarded.
Very cynical. Use that dry wit like armor.
Totally. But Gore forces her to confront her own stuff. Her family background, her identity as British Cambodian, her own kind of displacement mirrors his temporal one in a way.
It's a huge emotional awakening for her. She goes from just observing her life to actually, you know, taking a stand, finding some moral courage.
Yeah, it's profound.
Her change really pivots on him. But what about Gore? He comes from this time of, you know, stiff upper lips and duty. Does the novel suggest his Victorian honor is, like, outdated? Or does it actually hold up?
That's a great point. It's kind of both, isn't it? He definitely struggles. He's lost his context, his sense of purpose from the 19th century. He can't just slot into the modern world.
He has to integrate, not just assimilate.
Exactly. But the novel seems to argue that his core qualities, His decency, loyalty, that fundamental kindness, those things are timeless. They actually highlight maybe what's missing in the present.
And standing against this connection, or at least overseeing it with a very cold eye, is the ministry director, Maggie Kemble.
Ah, Kemble. She's formidable.
She really embodies the ethical tightrope the book walks. That cold, calculating utilitarianism, the idea that the needs of the future, the survival of the species, maybe justify, well, some pretty ruthless actions now.
Yeah, she's not a simple villain. Her motives are arguably about the greater good, which makes her much more chilling.
It really does. And that dynamic fuels the middle part of the book. You have this incredibly tender, but also really dangerous romance developing.
They fall into this strange intimacy in their government-assigned flat. It's domestic, but it's also completely forbidden and under surveillance.
Every shared glance, every conversation feels loaded because they know the risks. They cross that line.
They do. And it's consuming this love, but it's happening under the shadow of this huge impersonal institution that could crush them.
Exactly. And the threat isn't just about breaking HR rules. The narrator starts to suspect the ministry itself is hiding something bigger.
Yeah, her initial sort of maybe naive faith starts to crack. She picks up on inconsistencies, evasive answers from superiors.
And these hushed mentions of something called chronoclasm.
Chronoclasm, that word hangs in the air, doesn't it? It sounds ominous. And it's not like something they caused in the past. It's something they're anticipating.
A future disaster.
Seems like it. A temporal catastrophe they're trying to prepare for or mitigate somehow. And all the secrecy, the manipulation of the expats, Kemble's cold logic, it all starts to paint a much darker picture.
The quirky workplace starts feeling more like a conspiracy. Deep paranoia sets in.
It really does.
So the evidence keeps mounting, and she can't ignore it. She starts digging,
yeah,
covertly. What's the final piece? What's the horrifying truth she uncovers that just pulls the whole thing open?
It connects directly to the climate crisis. That's the gut punch. The ministry isn't just studying the past. They're preparing for a near future climate apocalypse.
Oh, wow.
And the expats. They weren't chosen just for historical insight. They were chosen because they survived extreme environments. Gore in the Arctic. Others who lived through plagues or wilderness conditions.
Who survival experts plucked from history.
Exactly. They're not guests being studied. They're human test subjects. Canaries in the coal mine, as the book puts it.
So the ministry can figure out how humanity's elite might survive when, you know, the environment collapses.
Precisely. Their acclimatization, their resilience. It's all data for survival protocols. It's exploitation on a temporal scale, taking people from the past, like resources.
Temporal colonialism, that's chilling. It completely flips the narrative, doesn't it? Suddenly it's a full-blown thriller.
Absolutely.
But the ending, it's not a big explosion. It's quieter, more personal.
It is. The narrator and Gore manage to get out from under the ministry's direct thumb. They escape immediate control.
And they choose each other. They choose their personal integrity, their love, over whatever twisted protection the ministry might offer.
Yeah, accepting this really uncertain future, knowing this apocalypse is looming, but choosing to face it together outside that corrupt system, it's bittersweet, but powerful.
It really underscores that central theme of displacement and belonging, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Gore's temporal alienation isn't so different from the narrator's cultural or emotional alienation.
Exactly. That shared feeling of being an outsider is what allows the bond. They don't belong to the time or maybe even the culture they're in, but they find belonging in each other.
Which then connects to the theme of power and exploitation. The ministry becomes this symbol of institutional cruelty, using vulnerability, the expat's displacement, as a resource to be mined.
It's a sharp critique. It mirrors how real-world systems sometimes treat vulnerable groups, like refugees or immigrants, more as data points or problems to be managed than as people.
Yeah, taking human capital from one context for the benefit of the powerful in another.
But amidst all that critique, the romance is still central. The theme of love across difference feels really key.
It's not about ignoring their vast differences, is it?
No, not at all. It's about creating a space, maybe just between the two of them, where those differences, 19th century versus 21st, different cultures, everything can actually coexist, maybe even enrich each other.
There's that beautiful, melancholic line you mentioned, to love a man from 1847 is to live with a ghost who is not dead.
Yeah, it captures that sense of him being tethered to his lost past and her becoming tethered to him, this living piece of history. It's beautiful and sad all at once.
And we experience all of this through the narrator's voice. First person, starts off so witty and sarcastic.
Almost detached.
But then it just melts into this incredible vulnerability as she connects with Gore and uncovers the truth. That voice makes it all believable.
It really does. And it leads to that stunning metaphor Bradley uses, which just perfectly sums up the book's heart, I think.
The past isn't a foreign country. It's a refugee camp.
Oof. Yeah. That just reframes everything, doesn't it? Our responsibility to the past, people displaced in any sense.
It shifts the perspective entirely.
And the novel ends up championing this kind of radical empathy. It suggests that maybe the bravest thing you can do when faced with these huge, impersonal, even existential threats is just choose love, choose humanity on a personal scale.
So I guess what this story really teaches us, ultimately, is that individual human lives, their dignity, their experiences, that has to matter more than some cold utilitarian calculation.
Even when the stakes are survival itself, it forces you to ask where the line is.
Right. It definitely leaves you thinking, if we had that kind of power, the power to save the future by exploiting the past, would we actually be saving the best of humanity? Or just ensuring the powerful survive?
A deeply unsettling question to end on. Outro sequence.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.